Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On manque d'ouvriers spécialisés dans le monde entier. Le métavers peut contribuer à résoudre ce problème. La plateforme de formation en réalité virtuelle de ForgeFX permet aux futurs soudeurs de s'entraîner encore et encore. Ils apprennent ainsi les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday, the 15th of March, these are our main stories. The US leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, has urged Israel to hold an election, describing Benjamin Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace. The US ambassador to Hungary has accused the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, of unhinged anti-American messaging and has warned him about his close relationship with Vladimir Putin. Spain's lower house of parliament has voted to give amnesty to Catalan separatists who defied the government in Madrid to hold an independence referendum in 2017. Also in this podcast... Another SpaceX test flight and another step closer to NASA's dreams of returning astronauts to the moon and beyond. The US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has called for an election in Israel, saying the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu no longer meets the needs of his country. Mr. Schumer is a Democrat and America's highest-ranking Jewish politician. He accused Mr. Netanyahu of pursuing dangerous and inflammatory policies.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel. He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Minister Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows.
Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party has responded to Senator Schumer, saying Israel is not a banana republic, but a proud democracy that elected its prime minister. The statement said a senator should respect Israel's elected government and not undermine it, even more so in wartime. Here's our North America correspondent, Tom Bateman.
Well, it's no secret that Chuck Schumer is a critic and an outspoken one of the current Israeli coalition. But this was a far more significant intervention than we have heard from him thus far. And given his position as the leader of the majority of the Democrats in the United States Senate, describing himself as the highest ranking Jewish elected official in American history, he then went on to really excoriate the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, during this very long speech, it was about 45 minutes, he started by saying that people should understand, as far as he was concerned, that Hamas bore the responsibility for unleashing the current war. But he then spoke about the impact of what he called the Israeli war machine in terms of the scale of civilian suffering in Gaza, but then moved on really to the longer term outlook. And he made it very clear that the only way through all this, in his view, was a two-state solution, Israel side by side with an independent, but he said demilitarized Palestinian state. And he then listed what he said were the four obstacles to this outcome. He listed Hamas, he listed extremist members of the Israeli government, he listed the Palestinian Authority leadership, and he also listed the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and repeatedly said these were the four obstacles to peace. And he said that if the current Israeli coalition continued along its current course, which he said was effectively an outlook to take all of the land, that Israel would have control over all of the land where Israelis and Palestinians live, he said that that would lead to international support for Israel declining further, and he said it would become a pariah state. So this was extremely outspoken, called for elections in Israel. That is something that will rile and has already riled, as we've heard from that statement from Likud, the current Israeli government. And he said that that is the way to have a sort of moment as the war wound down, he said, of debate and discussion about the way through. He said that he thought that the Israeli government had lost its way in terms of its current course and called for elections and is effectively calling for the replacement of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister.
Tom Bateman. Meanwhile, the United States has imposed sanctions on three Israeli settlers and two settler farming outposts in the occupied West Bank. All are accused of undermining stability there. It's the second time this year that Washington has imposed sanctions in response to rising settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank since the Hamas attack on southern Israel in October. The move freezes any US assets of the sanctioned individuals and entities and prohibits Americans from dealing with them. Cancer patients in Gaza say they're being denied exit for life-saving treatment through the Rafah crossing to Egypt, despite their names appearing on authorised evacuation lists. In parallel, fees charged by an Egyptian company arranging evacuations from Gaza have rocketed during the war, becoming unaffordable for most. The BBC's Lara El-Ghabali reports.
I'm on my way to the border crossing. Hopefully, I will find my name there and be able to travel. God willing.
This is Sehem's third time trying to leave Gaza. She was being treated for leukemia when the conflict began, leaving her and almost 10,000 other cancer patients in Gaza without treatment.
I read that my name was published on the Rafah coordination groups. My name was published on the departure list twice. I have been to the crossing point twice for no reason. I was turned away.
Despite her name being on an evacuation list for Turkey on November 19th, Sehem was turned away by Palestinian border agents, who said the Turkish envoy wasn't there to receive her. But we found that that wasn't the case. We spoke to Muna Al-Shurafi, who has breast cancer, and was on the same evacuation list as Sehem. She was allowed to leave for Turkey that day, and was even able to bring her two daughters with her.
After I got through the crossing onto the Egyptian side, I saw the Turkish consul waiting for us, and I knew I was going to Turkey.
We've spoken to two other cancer patients who have been turned away at the border despite their names being on the official evacuation lists. Officials in Turkey told the BBC they have the capacity to treat many hundreds more cancer patients. But only 600 cancer patients from Gaza have managed to leave since October 7. Israel vets who is allowed to leave Gaza. The Israeli Ministry of Defense told us that they have no restrictions on the number of patients allowed to leave for medical treatment. Palestinian border authorities declined to comment on Sehem's case. But it seems there are other ways to leave Gaza. A lucrative monopoly has emerged from the war, with one Egyptian travel agency, Hela, charging Palestinians $5,000 per person to exit Gaza within 1 to 2 weeks. This is more than four times the annual average salary in Gaza. This man says he had to pay an employee an extra $300 to get his family on the evacuation list. He didn't want to be identified, so we've changed his voice.
They weren't letting anyone in. If you wanted to go in, you had to pay to be let in. So then you could pay the $5,000. The fee was $5,000 for an adult and $2,500 for a child for Palestinian passport holders.
He is one of 10 people who told us they made extra payments of up to $4,000 to Hela employees to get their families evacuated. But it seems the best connected in Gaza can leave without paying at all. We found the names of Palestinians on an evacuation list meant for Egyptians. One of them told us they were helped to leave Gaza by someone with political connections. Neither Hela nor the Egyptian Foreign Ministry responded to our questions. In Gaza, time is running out for Sehem, whose cancer is spreading.
We are suffering now. My medicine is finished. I'm so tired. I can hardly see in front of me. No blood tests or anything. My chemotherapy ran out a long time ago.
Without the money or connections, many patients like Sahem have been left behind.
That report was by Lara El-Ghabali. The pioneering Starship rocket, developed by Elon Musk's company SpaceX, has made its longest and most ambitious test flight so far. Contact with Starship was broken as it began its re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. SpaceX confirmed that the craft was lost, but it completed nearly an entire test flight on its third attempt. The rocket ship blasted off from Texas and had been due to splash down in the Indian Ocean. SpaceX hopes Starship will eventually fly astronauts to the moon and beyond. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
With a mighty rumble, the giant rocket lifted clear of its Texan launch complex, all 33 engines firing at full power. The entrepreneur, Elon Musk, was looking for significant progress from his SpaceX team, and he got it.
And passing supersonic, so we're now moving faster than the speed of sound.
The ascent looked flawless. Separation of the bottom half, the booster, from the top half, the ship, occurred right on cue, with the ship then powering onwards out over the Atlantic. Video cameras sent back spectacular views of Earth. Then came the task of re-entry for a splashdown in the Indian Ocean.
Okay, we got a Starship on its way to space and a booster on the way back to the Gulf.
Video imagery again captured incredible scenes as hot gases enveloped the vehicle just before radio contact went down. Controllers reported shortly after that the ship had been lost, presumably because it had broken up. That will have disappointed engineers, but they'll know now that the development of the world's most powerful rocket is firmly on track. The aim is for Starship to be totally reusable, to fly again and again like an aeroplane. If that can be achieved, it would dramatically lower the cost of space activity.
Jonathan Amos. The US ambassador to Hungary has launched a stinging attack on the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, deepening a row between the two countries. Speaking in Budapest, David Pressman warned that Mr. Orban's close and expanding relationship with Russia and President Vladimir Putin was a security concern that could not be ignored. Nick Thorpe reports.
David Pressman made the remarks in a speech to mark the 25th anniversary of Hungary joining NATO. US concerns about the close relationship between Budapest and Moscow are shared by 31 NATO allies, Mr. Pressman said. If this is Hungary's policy choice, he added, we will have to decide how best to protect our security interests. This was the starkest warning from the Biden administration to Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban so far.
Nick Thorpe. Next to Germany and a group of protesters who are camping high in the trees outside Elon Musk's Tesla factory in the country could face eviction from Friday. Plans to expand the plant, which employs 12,000 people, have been facing fresh environmental protests. Tesla says its team is helping to improve local biodiversity and it's focused on creating sustainable factories. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports from the state of Brandenburg.
In a pine forest about 30 kilometres outside Berlin, I climb a ladder.
This is quite high, actually. I've never loved heights, but this feels pretty sturdy.
So we've come up about 20 feet into the trees. We're on a wooden deck, some orange tarpaulin, covering what is basically actually a workshop where they're storing nails and wood and rope and helmets. It's all part of the work of the camp. This is one of several tree houses making up the camp near Europe's only Tesla factory, the electric car company headed up by the charismatic but controversial Elon Musk. These activists want to frustrate plans for the factory's expansion into the forest. But as I find out from one of the campaigners, Magpie...
Okay, I think it's ready.
Up with trees, down with capitalism.
Yeah, that's like the motto.
Their protest is about much more.
We don't want to cut this forest down. We want to save or to protect the water here. But also it's like a more international fight because, of course, electric cars also use minerals or things like lithium, which also cause a lot of problems in for example, Chile or Bolivia.
There's been some suggestion some of you guys are basically professional campaigners turning up at lots of protests wherever they may be.
I mean, I think that's not true. Of course, some people are here who are doing this like often or sometime, but also a lot of people here who live here next to the or live in the village Grünheide are like coming here and helping us. Yeah, I also have to work, of course. I'm not like doing this my whole time or whole life.
He rope climbs up to his treehouse. There's no ladder here. The idea, of course, is to make a looming eviction particularly hard for the authorities. At a railway nearby, we bump into commuters. A majority of residents in the local town voted against the plans, but views are split. The expansion proposals include a kindergarten for employees, warehouses and a freight train station.
Actually, this is a problem for us. I live here and moved to Grünheide 20 years ago because we wanted to be close to the nature and so on, and we didn't expect that we would have this kind of factory here close to the houses. No?
I think most of the people don't agree with the people that are camping. Most of the Tesla employees are happy that Tesla is providing workplaces. I personally don't really understand the motivations of the people camping here and attacking our power system.
That attack on the power system was a suspected arson attack on an electricity pylon that led to factory production being suspended for a week. But campaigners at the camp say that was not them. In fact, far-left militant activists called the Volcano Group have claimed responsibility. Police are investigating.
Unstoppable force.
A Tesla video released this week sent the message that the factory was booming back to life. Elon Musk even visited the plant, having described the pylon saboteurs as dumb eco-terrorists. Meanwhile, Tesla says it wants to create sustainable factories and support local communities. But American powerhouse capitalism is meeting radical German eco-activism. It's likely that battle isn't over yet.
That report was by Jessica Parker in Germany. Still to come, we hear about a huge Philippines-based love scam.
The profiles we make up are always very handsome. The pig butchering scam is all about exploiting emotion. This is how to win their trust.
Hi, I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're the hosts of a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Where to Be a Woman. So, what's the podcast about, Saatchi?
It's all about where in the world women are living their best lives, what female wellness looks like globally, and what the rest of us may be able to learn from it.
And where can people find it?
Just search for Where to Be a Woman wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The motive behind the abduction of nearly 300 schoolchildren in northern Nigeria last week appears to be simple greed. Ransom demands have been made by the kidnappers, but many of the families are very poor and the money demanded, more than $500,000, is way beyond what they can afford. I spoke to our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
Well, we've heard from a community leader in Kuriga, the area of Kaduna State, where the children and some teachers were taken from. This man, Jibril Gwadabe, told the BBC that he had spoken with the group, including the kidnappers as well, but also heard from the head teacher who was taken with them and heard that the children aged between 7 and 12 are in a pretty sorry state, mainly because of the very long trek they were forced to go on through the bush to get to the kind of lair where these kidnapping gangs are based in forests. He said that some of them couldn't stand up, they were so weak, and also talked about how little food and water is available for them. You know, they're sleeping out under the trees. It's pretty rough conditions. And frankly, he fears that some of them won't survive.
And Will, I was saying that a lot of these parents are very simple people. They're not particularly wealthy. How likely is any payment of a ransom?
Well, Jibril Gwadabe was pretty blunt when he said there's absolutely no chance of a ransom being paid because people have so little.
Many of the fathers of these children, I can tell you, I swear to God, they are not in possession of even 5,000 naira. Even if you ask any parent of these children to give, let's say, 20,000, I swear, many of them do not have this money.
Well, to put that into context, 5,000 naira is about $3, isn't it? They can't even afford that. What do you think will happen without payment?
Well, it's always hard to know what goes on behind the scenes. With previous kidnappings, clearly huge amounts of money have been paid, sometimes involving officials, but the government and or the state government or the federal government never admit that ransom payments are made. In fact, they've even made the paying of ransoms illegal. But we think it still goes on. There is, of course, also a military option, but high risk. But there are some reports that more than 4,000 people have been kidnapped since President Tinubu came into power last May. And that the fact of the matter is, there haven't really been prosecutions of the gang leaders. And for many people, it looks as though it still is a reasonably easy way to make quick money.
Will Ross. Back in 2017, the streets of Barcelona and other cities in northeastern Spain were alive with people waving red and yellow Catalan flags. They were part of a concerted bid for independence. In October of that year, Catalan nationalists carried out a referendum on breaking away from Madrid, and that had been declared illegal by the Constitutional Court. After that, a number of the organisers were imprisoned. But now the Spanish Congress has approved a controversial amnesty law for people still facing legal action for separatist activity. I asked our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, who would benefit from the amnesty.
Around 300 or so Catalan nationalists are expected to benefit from the amnesty. Many of those people have links to the failed bid for independence in 2017. So, for example, civil servants or head teachers, for example, who allowed their schools to be used for that referendum that was deemed illegal. Many people like that have been facing legal action ever since. But there are other much more high-profile figures who have also been facing legal action, most notably Carles Puigdemont, who was the Catalan regional president back then, and he was seen as the figurehead of the independence movement at the time. He has been exiled in Belgium ever since to avoid the reach of the Spanish courts. There are also, I should mention, police officers who were accused of attacking Catalan voters on the day of the referendum who could also benefit from the amnesty as well.
It sounds as though both sides of the argument, if you like, will potentially benefit from this. And yet it's been very divisive. It was only narrowly passed, wasn't it? Why?
Yes, because the focus has really been on the nationalists who will benefit from this, in particular people like Carles Puigdemont, the former Catalan president. And critics of this amnesty say, first of all, that the amnesty is unconstitutional. They also say that Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is only pushing this amnesty through because he needs the support in Parliament of Catalan nationalist parties. So he's just doing this for his own political survival. And that obviously jars with Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's own claims that the amnesty will try and reduce political and social tensions in Catalonia that were generated by that failed bid for secession.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid there. A Royal Air Force plane reportedly carrying the British Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, has had its satellite signal jammed while flying near the Russian territory of Kaliningrad. Mr. Shapps was travelling back to the UK after watching NATO military exercises. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
The Defence Secretary's plane was briefly jammed on both legs of a trip to Poland. A security source told the BBC the safety of the plane was never threatened and that it's not unusual for aircraft to experience GPS jamming close to the strategically important Russian exclave of Kaliningrad on the Baltic Sea. Another Western official pointed out that Kaliningrad, which sits between two NATO members, Poland and Lithuania, has significant electronic warfare capabilities and that it wouldn't be surprising to see them used against commercial aircraft. Grant Shapps was flying on an RAF corporate jet. According to the Washington-based Institute for the Study of War, Russia's use of GPS interference across Poland and the Baltic has proliferated in recent months, possibly to disrupt NATO exercises. But it's also interfering with commercial shipping and aircraft. Ships and planes have other means of navigation, but such jamming could have dangerous consequences. Russia's use of electronic warfare is also helping Moscow to turn the tide of the war in Ukraine.
Paul Adams. In London, a High Court judge who has overseen a long-running legal battle about who invented the cryptocurrency Bitcoin has ruled that it is not the Australian computer scientist Dr. Craig Wright. For years, Dr. Wright has claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonym used by the person or team who launched Bitcoin in 2008, and he's challenged in court those who questioned his story. Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy, watched the court proceedings.
Mr. Justice Mellor took just a few seconds to rule that Wright was not the inventor of Bitcoin. It had been expected that the judge would take months to decide on this technically complex and at times tetchy five-week trial. But he said the evidence was overwhelming. During the trial, Dr. Wright was accused of carrying out a massive campaign of dishonesty and forgery in the years since he claimed to be Bitcoin's inventor. It was in 2016 that the Australian computer scientist outed himself as the elusive Satoshi Nakamoto, the online user who created and launched Bitcoin on the internet in 2008. Dr. Wright invited the BBC to a demonstration to prove it. But it wasn't long before his claims were questioned, and since then doubt has spread that he is Satoshi. He's been in and out of court multiple times, filing legal challenges against anyone who questions his story. This High Court case, brought by Copper, a group of Bitcoin-based businesses, appears to have put his case to bed. But the mystery of who invented Bitcoin, which has surged in value during the trial, continues.
Joe Tidy. Police in the Philippines say that they've rescued around 700 people from a centre 100 kilometres north of the capital, Manila. They say the people were working against their will in an online love scam. Rachel Wright has more.
The police raided the centre on Thursday after a tip-off from a Vietnamese man who managed to flee last month. The 30-year-old said he had arrived in January after being offered what he was told would be a chef's job. But he soon realised that he had fallen prey to human traffickers running love and cryptocurrency scams. He told police that he'd been forced to send online messages he described as sweet nothings to his victims, many of whom were Chinese. The police said he showed signs of torture, including scars and marks from electrocution. Southeast Asia has become a hub for scam centres, where the scammers themselves are often entrapped and forced into criminal activity. Those running the scam centres trap good-looking men and women to lure victims by posing as their online lovers. They then persuade the victims into parting with their money. The BBC spoke to one man who didn't want to reveal his identity for fear that his former colleagues would kill him, about how he ran what he called pig butchering scams, named after the farming practice of fattening pigs before slaughtering them.
The profiles we make up are always very handsome, very rich, responsible and caring. The pig butchering scam is all about exploiting emotion. This is how to win their trust. You create a dream. I want to live with you in Beijing. We could make that happen together. You get the investors to invest as much as possible and drain every single penny.
Joyce was one of those tricked into investing on a fake website.
The pressure I face as a leftover woman was probably the main reason I was scammed. My scammer said he'd come to Beijing to see me in January. We could think about buying a home together. I borrowed from 9 online lenders, including my own savings. I lost about $100,000, and my family blamed me for being stupid.
The BBC also obtained footage from activists which shows how many of the people in the centres were treated. The videos show young men tied to chairs being beaten. A UN report last August estimates that hundreds of thousands of people from around the world have been trafficked to Southeast Asia to work in online scams. Governments across Asia, from Indonesia to Taiwan, have expressed alarm at the rise in these scam centres. Foreign embassies in countries like Cambodia and Thailand have issued warnings to their citizens to beware of being lured into these practices.
Rachel Wright. a group of wealthy homeowners in the United States who spent more than $500,000 creating a sand dune to protect their seaside homes has seen the barrier vanish in just 3 days. Gabrielle Sungo-Light reports.
The group in Massachusetts had hoped to protect themselves from coastal erosion and flooding by building a huge artificial dune using 14,000 tons of sand. But just days after completing it, the barrier was destroyed by a storm. The homeowners are now hoping the state authorities will help them to find a permanent solution to protect the property. Many coastal homes are in danger in the US. An official report last year suggested that about 1 in 4 Americans live in coastal areas are vulnerable to natural disasters.
Gabrielle Sungo-Light. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Charlotta Torzymska. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.